May it please the court. My name is Leslie Tuft of Solon Sandgren Smith and Perzak, number 34671. For the appellant and the plaintiffs below, Mark A. Hildebrand and Mark L. Hildebrand. Ron Sandgren of the same firm is with me at council table. And I'd like to reserve 10 minutes of my time to respond to the cross-appeal arguments and for rebuttal.
It'll be up to you to keep.
Okay. All right. This is a Construction Defect and Deceptive Practices Act case. The Hildebrands, who are father and son and a retired police officer and a current police officer, sued the builder of their home, New Vista Homes, and its principal and manager and sole employee, Richard Reeves, for tort, contract, and statutory claims. The claims arise from the home's construction defects and the defendant's misrepresentations and failures to disclose material facts regarding the home. Despite previously denying Mr. Reeves' motion for summary judgment on all of his individual liability claims, the trial court directed a verdict for Mr. Reeves at the trial, and holding that the evidence was insufficient for the individual claims against him. The jury returned a verdict for the Hildebrands on all of the claims against New Vista. And Hildebrands are appealing three of the trial court holdings. First, the directed verdict in favor of Mr. Reeves. Second, the trial court's refusal to award the Hildebrands prejudgment interest on their emotional distress damages awarded under the CCPA. And third, the trial court's refusal to award prejudgment interest on the Hildebrands damages awarded for breach of implied warranty. I'm going to start with personal liability. When determining whether a directed verdict is appropriate, both the trial court and the appellate court have to consider the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party and draw all inferences in that party's favor. And in on this point of law, it's well settled in Colorado that corporate employees are personally liable for their torts and statutory violations that they approve of, direct, actively participate in, or cooperate in. And the case is Wong, and also that holding is supported by a long line of cases in Colorado. Mr. Reeves' status as an employee of New Vista doesn't relieve him of his liability for his own obligation or for his own actions, even if his actions were taken on behalf of New Vista. And the defendants here concede that this standard applies, and they cited it in the trial court. However, the trial court misapprehended the law when it held that Reeves was entitled to directed verdict. And the court held that agents of legal entities are not personally liable for actions, quote, taken as a manager or officer or director of a corporation, close quote. And that holding can be found in the CD record at page 1042, lines 16 to 20. So once the appropriate standard is applied here, it's clear that the trial court record is replete with evidence of Mr. Reeves' own individual conduct that's actionable. The Hildebrands aren't seeking to pierce the corporate veil or hold Mr. Reeves liable for New Vista's actions that he didn't approve of, direct, actively participate in, or cooperate in. And here, Mr. Reeves argues that there's no evidence of wrongful conduct in the briefs, but the only way he can make that argument is to ignore the trial record, which is has more than ample evidence to support a jury finding in favor of the Hildebrands on the individual claims. For example, Mr. Reeves was the one who decided to use slab-on-grade floors in the homes despite soils engineer recommendations that he shouldn't do so. He was the one who decided not to install sump pumps in the homes despite the soils engineer's recommendations that the homes needed those. He was the one who decided to advertise the homes for sale with available basement bathroom plumbing and egress windows for later finishing, despite his knowledge that if he was going to build all the homes with slab-on-grade floors, the basements wouldn't be suitable for finishing. He was the one who authorized and approved the admittedly false representations that the home came with a 10-year structural warranty as a standard feature. He was the one who authorized and approved the advertising materials that said that the homes came with individual lot soils reports, implying that the soils engineer's recommendations as to the homes had been followed. So it's obvious from the record that the jury could have found Reeves personally liable. And in fact, the jury already found New Vista liable based on Reeves' personal conduct. Because the company can only act through its employees or agents, and Reeves was New Vista's only employee and the only person that had the authority to make these wrongful decisions, the jury's decision had to be based on Reeves' own conduct. And here in Vista was a one-man company, and Reeves was that man. And the defendants haven't explained how, who at New Vista did these wrongful acts if it wasn't Mr. Reeves. Because the jury could have easily found Reeves personally liable, the directed verdict should be reversed. Moving on to the first prejudgment interest issue, the trial court erroneously failed to award prejudgment interest under CRS 1321-101 on the Hildebrand CCPA emotional distress damages because it incorrectly it incorrectly concluded that CCPA violations do not constitute torts. 1321-101 provides that for prejudgment interest on personal injury damages that arise from torts. Defendants don't dispute that the emotional distress damages are personal injury damages, so the only narrow legal question on the appeal here is whether a statutory violation constitutes a tort within the meaning of the statute. It's well settled in Colorado that any violation of a non-contractual duty is a tort. In the Heisman case, the Colorado Supreme Court held that a tortious act, quote, includes any conduct other than breach of contract that constitutes a civil wrong and causes injury or damages. Recently, in the U.S. Facts Law Center case, the appeals court held that a violation of a federal statute likewise constituted a tort. While New Vista wants to construe the word narrowly to avoid the prejudgment interest here, the cases they rely on are outdated and inapplicable, and they're not currently relied on today. And it's well settled that a statutory violation is a tort. And because these personal injury damages resulted from a tort, prejudgment interest should have been awarded, and so this part of the judgment should also be reversed and remanded to the trial court. The final prejudgment interest issue is the breach of implied warranty damages. And the trial court erred when it failed to award prejudgment interest under Section 5-12-1021B on the Hildebrand's breach of implied warranty damages. That section provides for prejudgment interest on money damages under two circumstances. First, after they are wrongfully withheld, and second, after they become due. And any interpretation of the statute must give effect to both parts of the statute. And traditionally, the phrase wrongfully withheld has been applied to tort claims, and the phrase after they become due has been applied to contract claims, as in the Ballo versus FICO insurance case. Money damages become due upon a warranty's breach. The Ballo court held, quote, one who's damaged by a breach of contract is entitled to recover prejudgment interest from the time of the breach. New Vista argues that the Goodyear case controls and precludes prejudgment interest on the Hildebrand's breach of implied warranty damages. However, Goodyear is distinguishable here for two reasons. First, it involved only tort, not contract-based claims, and it was a product liability claim at issue in the case. And second, it only construed the phrase wrongfully withheld, and it didn't address the other part of the statute, after they become due, which applies here. Goodyear, in fact, the court said in that decision, quote, in a contract action, the wrongful withholding of the plaintiff's money or property occurs at the time of the breach. It was explained that the prejudgment interest begins to accrue at the time of the breach in contract actions. Vista argues that in Goodyear, the court noted that the statute wasn't intended to distinguish between breach of contract actions and other types of cases, but to the extent that the court was saying that the analysis is always the same in breach of contract versus tort cases, it's mere dicta because that case again was a tort case, not a contract case, and it only construed the phrase wrongfully withheld. Also, prejudgment interest accrues differently in the two types of cases because the two types of cases deal with two completely different legal theories, two different parts of the prejudgment interest statute, two different kinds of damages, where tort damages are intended to compensate, contract damages are intended to meet the party's expectancy interest, and there are different purposes behind the prejudgment interest awarded for these two types of damages. For example, in the Mesa Sand case, which Goodyear did not overrule, the court explained that one of the purposes of the prejudgment interest statute is to discourage a person responsible for payment of a claim from stalling and delaying payment until settlement or judgment. And also another purpose of the prejudgment interest statute where expectancy damages are awarded is to deprive the breaching party of the benefit of its breach. In a breach of contract case, when a party breaches the contract, it knows it's breached the contract and that it's required to pay the non-breaching party its expectancy interest damages, but and that party should be deprived of the benefit of its breach. Moodist also argues that the Hildebrands are not entitled to prejudgment interest because they sought prospective damages rather than past due breach of contract damages. However, the Hildebrands' damages for the breach of warranty will not reimburse them for future losses or injuries, but for a past loss. That is the deprivation of a contractual benefit, a home that meets Colorado's implied warranty standards.
Hildebrands didn't spend any money until time to repair the structural defect, is that right? So they get to keep the money. They're not out any money until it's spent for repairs.
Right, but
how does that fit in with the purposes behind the award of prejudgment interest?
Well, because the twin purposes are to discourage a person responsible for payment to stall and delay payment, and it also fits in squarely with the purposes of SIDARA, which is to encourage early settlement of claims. And if there's no consequence for withholding money after it's due, then that purpose isn't furthered. There's no incentive to there's all the incentive to delay the payment rather than to make the payment and resolve the case early.
They did have damages for the inconvenience, right? So doesn't that compensate for the time period before they actually got around to doing repairs, which may have never happened?
Their damages in this case were not limited to their repair damages. That there were other damages. And because this is a breach of contract claim, the breach of implied warranty, the damages are the expectancy interest, and the Hildebrand incurred those damages at the time of the breach when they should have been paid, but they weren't. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Excuse me, I guess that's as far as it goes. Good afternoon. I'm Catherine Eubank. I represent both New Vista and Mr. Rick Reeves, who is in the courtroom with us today, as well as trial counsel Adam Linton. And the main point is that the trial court got it right when it directed a verdict as to Mr. Reeves, and the trial court got it wrong as a matter of law on several issues with regard to letting the case go to the jury against New Vista. The following issues are legal issues that should have been determined by the judge, should not have gone to the jury, should not have allowed the plaintiffs to present evidence and arguments and jury instructions that persuaded the jury that there was something wrong when New Vista did nothing wrong. Point number one is that this case is the exact opposite of Wang versus Arbess. In Wang versus Arbess, we're talking about a sole shareholder of a builder vendor who managed each step of construction, oversaw the subcontractors, intentionally disregarded specific warnings and recommendations of the soils engineer, including the warning not to build on the property at all. In Wang, the same individual knew that the construction did not comply with the engineering recommendations, but failed to instruct the subcontractors that he oversaw to make corrections. And finally, that same sole shareholder manager of the builder instructed the salespeople to affirmatively misrepresent that the engineering prevented the risk of expansive soils. None of those things are true in this case.
Let me ask a couple questions. Didn't Mr. Reeves personally make the decision, which was at odds with the engineer's recommendation on sump pumps?
With regard to sump pumps, I don't believe there was a specific engineering recommendation that a sump pump had to be put into every single lot. The perimeter drains were put in where there wasn't water. There was no need for a sump pump. And what we're talking about here, I mean, the damages that are at issue have to do with the use of the slab-on-grade building. It doesn't have to do with the sump pump. So to make the distinction between Wang in this case, Mr. Reeves was not a sole shareholder manager of the LLC. There were two members of the LLC. He did not manage the construction because the LLC hired a completely separate entity that was not brought in as a party to be the construction manager. He didn't go to the site. He didn't oversee what the subcontractors were doing. He didn't schedule the subcontractors.
Was the construction manager a company?
He's involved in that. I don't know that he's a sole owner or operator of that, but he wasn't the person involved in the construction management of the project. He didn't personally go and do the scheduling and run the subcontractors and so forth.
And the decision, though, about whether to put slab on grade or structural foundation, it wasn't the independent contractors who made that decision.
No, you're correct. And here's going back to Judge Webb's first question. There was nothing at odds between what the soils engineer, Mr. Garner from Terracon, advised New Vista it could do. Mr. Garner gave the option and said, you can either use slab on grade if you're willing to tolerate the risk of movement, or you can put in a structural floor if you're really risk adverse.
Didn't he recommend with respect to the structural floor and only indicate that the slab floor was a possible choice if people were willing to tolerate the movement?
I don't have the exact language in front of me, but what he testified to at trial was that his intent was that it was an either-or situation depending upon whether the risk was tolerable or not.
And you're saying at trial he disavowed any recommendation one way or the other?
I'm saying that at trial he said that he recommended a structural floor if you couldn't tolerate the risk. If you want to avoid the risk altogether, then you recommend a structural floor, but that it was equally an option, acceptable option within his engineering judgment for New Vista to use a slab on grade floor. And in this case, what happened was that Mr. Reeves, on behalf of New Vista, you know, not acting in his individual capacity, but acting as a corporate representative of New Vista, decided on this particular lot to use the slab on grade, and the Hildebrands purchased the house while it was being constructed, so the slab on grade was already there.
That decision had been made by Mr. Reeves.
That decision was made by Mr. Reeves, but it was not at odds with the engineering recommendation. That's why this was something that needed to be decided by the trial court, not by the jury, because the jury obviously got confused about this. But the plain language, reading both the engineering reports and the purchase agreement, the option was passed on to the purchaser. There was a wealth of information about the risks that were involved with the slab-on-grade construction. And the choice was given to the purchaser either to have slab-on-grade or to pay extra for structural. In this case, the house was already being built, but the Hildebrands didn't have to buy this house. There were other lots available. They could have had the home built the way they wanted, and they didn't have to buy from New Vista. So basically, the option was given to the purchaser, and Mr. Reeves made the decision initially to build this lot that way, but it was not in opposition to the recommendations of the engineer.
Ask a question about that. As I understand the record, wasn't there conflicting testimony at trial by the engineer? On some occasions, I thought he stated pretty unequivocally that his recommendation was that they should all be structural floors. And then you're saying there are other occasions when he apparently said it was neither or. Doesn't that leave it up to the jury to decide what they're going to believe?
No, Your Honor, and this is why. It's because we're talking about documents. We're talking about construction documents and the interpretation of reports as a matter of law should have been determined by the trial court and not gone to the jury at all. And
I apologize, I want to finish
responding to your question. Mr. Garner's testimony, he clarified what he meant, and it clearly states in the both the project wide soils report and in the lot soils report that either or was an option. And he testified at trial, clarified that what he meant was that either was an option, but if you want to avoid all risk, then you've got to do a structural floor.
In order to make the basement suitable for finishing out, then the structural floor was necessary. And you're saying that was explained in the purchase agreement, but then there were also some handwritten, not applicable notations. So wouldn't that create an issue to the jury as to what a purchaser was informed about as far as the slab on grade or the structural floor?
Again, I disagree that it's a factual issue because, we're talking about a contract. We're talking about a document for the trial court to construe and interpret. And in this case, the not applicable language, one, there was a fact issue as to whether or not as to who did it, right, as to whether it was the Hildebrands or as to whether it was the sales rep, who again was working for another entity and was only an agent, an independent contractor hired by New Vista. But in any event, the not applicable markings are attached as Exhibit B, I believe, to the Hildebrand's answer reply brief. And so it's handy there in the briefing for you. But the only not applicable markings are Exhibit F and Exhibit G, and not any of the internal disclaimers. Paragraphs 12 and paragraphs 13 go on forever talking about explaining what the risks are and the difference between the flooring systems and the disclaimers. And there's no not any applicables on those due to the weight of the fact that, you know, the not applicables is not pertinent to, it's not drawn through the disclaimers. There's no factual issue about whether or not the disclaimers were part of the contract. The disclaimers were part of the contract. There's they're not crossed out. And another thing that's important to distinguish with regard to the Wang case and this case is that in Wang, the manager that we're talking about was actively involved in overseeing. He was on the site. He was making decisions. He knew that the construction did not comply with the engineering recommendations. In this case, Mr. Reeves doesn't have any kind of intent or subjective knowledge about this. His only basis of information, because he's not an engineer, is what the engineer says. And what the engineer says is, both in the project-wide report and in the lot-specific report, you can do either of these. And so Mr. Reeves has no subjective intent to act against the engineering recommendations. He was acting in conformity with the engineering recommendations. And the last point in Wang is instructing the salespeople to affirmatively represent that the engineering prevented the risk of expansive soils. Well, that's obviously not the situation in this case. In this case, there were disclosures up to here, you know, in the purchase agreement, in the lot specific report, and also publication 43. And I know you're going to ask if there's a fact issue with regard to whether publication 43 was disclosed by the salesperson. The salesperson said he gave it to everybody. He gave that pamphlet to everybody. That's what Mr. Reeves instructed him to do, and that's what he did. And the suggestion or the testimony by the Hildebrands at trial shouldn't come in at all. That's parole evidence going against the express and unambiguous terms of the purchase agreement.
Was there testimony on publication 43 objected to on that basis?
I do not believe that it was specifically objected to on that basis. However, the entire issue was brought up before trial as part of the summary judgment motion, And I know that, the Hildebrands have argued that, that we can't go back and look at the situation on summary judgment, but I believe that when there's a whole series of legal errors by the court, there's not factual disputes, but stepping back and there are legal errors by the court, you can look at what the situation was on summary judgment. The evidence that came in at trial, the case should have been let go at summary judgment. Because it wasn't, a whole bunch of stuff came in at trial, both evidence and arguments, and the jury was allowed to consider what was essentially legally a wrong argument legally. And so the whole trial was tainted. And the panel may already be aware, but the Supreme Court of the United States Supreme Court is getting ready on November 1st to hear a case, Ortiz versus Jordan, and it's a Supreme Court number, docket number 09737, and that concerns the issue of when you're allowed to review matters on appeal after trial based on the denial of a pretrial motion for summary judgment. And the arguments in that case are that the majority of courts, at least in the federal system, are that when it's an issue of law and not of evidence, if the trial court has erred in construing the law or applying the law, you can review that after trial, even though the arguments were made on summary judgment before trial. And I know that's not necessarily precedent for this court, but certainly I think it's an issue that looks like a lot of appellate courts are looking at, and hopefully we'll get some guidance on that. So that's the Wang case. The public policy that the court should be enforcing with regard to the issue of Wang is that project owners, especially those who aren't the big companies that have their own in-house engineers and their own employee people who do the investigations and all that, if, you know, project owners have to rely on independent contractors and the licensed professionals to do the investigations, to make the recommendations. And the Wayne case basically said it's because the individual project manager knew that he was disregarding the recommendations of the engineer, that's why he was individually liable. This is not that case.
The structural engineer testified that Mr. Reeves decided that he wasn't going to put structural floors in any of these homes. Now, doesn't that alone create a fact issue for the jury? And I'm not prejudging that it was believable, but why doesn't that testimony alone create a fact issue?
Well, we're putting the cart before the horse when we're talking about whether a testimony makes a fact issue that takes it out of a summary judgment issue. But basically, the recommendations for the project-wide report for all of the projects all have the same either or. You can do either or. The engineer gave NuVista the option to do that. And so it doesn't matter whether NuVista did it in one house or multiple houses. If someone had come by wanting to purchase a NuVista home, NuVista would have put in a structural floor if they had asked for it. It would have cost more money, and that's the point. Giving the consumer the option as to whether they want to spend more money for a structural floor, resist movement, or pay less money for a slab on grade that might move. The plumbing was installed specifically for laundry and so forth, non-living surfaces.
Is it described in the documents as a bathroom?
No, I believe that that's been misrepresented as well. If you look at the purchase agreement, there's language, I don't know if it must be in paragraph 13, and I don't have it right in front of me, that specifies that if you're not using a structural floor, the plumbing is only to be used for laundry and non-living surfaces, not for a bathroom. There is an option for an additional bathroom up on the floor with the bedrooms, for a whole additional room plus an additional bedroom, but that's not the issue here. Because my time is running out quickly, I've got several more legal issues that the court should have decided as a matter of law instead of sending to the jury. The first one is looking at whether or not those disclaimers are enforceable as a matter of law. All you have to do for that is look at the contract language. It's unambiguous, therefore you don't need any parallel evidence, therefore you enforce it as written. The public policy on that is that purchasers should be allowed to make fully informed decisions regarding engineered approved options, and sellers should be able to rely on the engineering recommendations and purchaser decisions without facing liability. The third issue, as a matter of law, no vicarious liability. This is an issue that the plaintiffs have the burden of proof on. They have the burden to prove that New Vista was liable and therefore is liable for the actions of the independent contractors. There's no vicarious liability, no exception for residential home builders just because they have to use outside engineers and subcontractors to perform the work. If the builder is not on site overseeing this, making the decisions, and they're not negligent in their own conduct, and there was no negligent hiring claim in this case, there's no evidence that New Vista was itself negligent in any way, merely because it relied on the recommendations of the engineer. The fourth is that there's no public impact on the CCPA claim. This case involved just the one contract for the purchase of one house. There was no evidence that any other homeowners were damaged.
So there's no evidence that the floors had heaved in any of the other homes?
There's nothing like that admitted at trial.
Was there any evidence as to approximately how many prospective owners were given the allegedly misleading sales literature on the 10-year warranty and the basement bath option?
I don't believe there was as to the 10-year warranty issue. I think the main argument that the Hildebrands have made is regard to this disclosure of the soils report and whether or not the lot specific report is sufficient and meets the Soils Act obligation and any obligation to disclose material information. Fifth, the purchase price of the house, brand new, was $269,509. Two appraisers testified that the house had a market value of $255,000 to $260,000, including an appraiser hired by the Hildebrands. Evidence was not contravened. The Hildebrands did not present any evidence that the purchase price of the house or the market value of the house was any higher than that, and yet the court sent this to the jury as a fact issue and allowed the jury to come back with a core damage award of over $400,000, which is more than $100,000 than the house was worth to begin with.
Your time's exhausted.
Thank you.
You may proceed however you want, but I would like you to address at some point in your rebuttal what evidence there was that would satisfy the public impact element of the CCPA, particularly specific evidence in the record, if any, that the floors in other homes had failed, and the number or extent of public dissemination of the allegedly misleading sales literature. But you don't have to start there.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to begin with the personal liability issue. Reeves argues that this case is the opposite of Wong and that there is no liability here because the case is distinguishable. But again, and also there's been some mischaracterization of the evidence on the record. There were four soils reports in this case. The three of them expressly said on lots 1 through 38, structural floors are recommended. Reeves had personal conversations with Garner about all four soils reports. And the four soils report said structural floors are recommended. It also said that structural floors are recommended, but if you can tolerate a lot of this movement, you could use this other form. However, Garner testified that he made clear to Reeves in their conversations that he was not backing off his recommendation that structural floors should be used in all of these homes. This isn't a parole evidence issue. It's not an issue of an interpretation of the language. There's testimony from the soils engineer that he told Reeves. Reeves knew this. They had conversations about it. Reeves asked him, "Well, could I, use this other kind, this other type of floor? Because some of the boring samples, they seem to be not as expansive as some of the other boring samples." Garner testified, and this is all in the opening brief, that he explained to Reeves that the soil samples are variable, and a lot of the soil samples in this area had highly expansive soils, and so that he would characterize the soils of this home as moderately to highly expansive, and that he recommended that all of these homes on lots 1 through 38 were built with structural floors, and that creates at least a fact issue for the jury whether that was improper conduct. Reeves also the disclosures in the documents about the 10-year warranty, the defendants argued that these were clear and they explained exactly what was going on to the prospective purchasers, but nothing in the contract explains that the 10-year structural warranty only applies if you buy an optional second year limited warranty. And in the contract, it explains the first year limited warranty and what covers that, what is covered by that. And then you can buy a second year of this, but it doesn't explain that the only way you're going to get the 10-year structural warranty that we advertised as a standard feature is if you also buy the second year warranty. The contract
Help me understand that. The buyer gets the structural warranty in years 3 through 10 regardless, right? So the only issue is possible misunderstanding over a gap in coverage in year 2.
Right. The buyers thought they were getting a 10-year warranty and now defendants argue they weren't, that's not what they were getting. Also, these homes were advertised with basements suitable for finishing. It's not true that the plumbing in the basement was only for laundry rooms. Let me stop you there.
Let's clarify what you mean by advertising. I don't want to put words in your mouth. Do you mean the literature given to people who stopped by the site and expressed interest, or is there some mass media, does the record include evidence of some sort of mass media advertising?
Well, the site included a model home where the sales representative sat and where people came to look at the home and look at the homes that Reeves was building. And he admitted at trial that he told his sales reps to represent that the basements could be finished and that he did it to induce them to purchase his homes rather than the competitors.
But when you use the word advertising, you're not talking about something in the Denver Post. You're talking about representations made on-site or literature passed out on-site, correct?
Right, or representations authorized, that Reeves authorized his sales representatives to make. And, Your Honor, there were brochures and handed out also at the site, and I believe that one of them does say something about rough and basement bathrooms, but it's all in the opening brief. It's all cited in the record there. Okay, so Your Honors, we stressed it's an interest case from Wong by arguing that here there are two members of the LLC, but it's not disputed that the other person was a financial partner and had nothing to do with these construction decisions. They argue that there was another party who was a construction manager, but that in fact is not the evidence. The evidence is that Reeves hired his stepson to be a construction superintendent, and he also testified that this superintendent did not have the authority to make the major construction decisions. He testified that he was the only one that had the authority to make these decisions, and these decisions are the wrongful decisions, and thus there's at least a jury question if Reeves is personally liable. The defendants argue that the purchasers were provided with, quote unquote, a wealth of information, and that they were then given the opportunity to have the option to purchase a structural floor or a slab-on-grade floor. However, The purchasers were not given the opportunity to make an informed decision. There was information in the sales documents, but it was not complete information. It left out the fact that Reeves decided not to install sump pumps in the sump pits. The sales reports said that suitable drainage systems needed to be installed, such as sump pumps and sump pits. And Reeves admitted at trial that he understood that, but that he decided that only a sump pump would only be installed if there was standing water when the sump pit was dug, and that was contrary to the recommendations in the report.
Can you help me understand? Because it seems counterintuitive that the plaintiffs would get on the high side of $400,000 in damages fixing a house that they only paid $260 or $270 for. Help me understand why that's a fair award of damages.
That's the required cost to repair all of the defects that the defendants created.
Well, but how is it reasonable to spend more correcting defects than the house cost in the first place, which isn't apparently undisputed?
I believe that the repair cost was more than the house cost in the first place, but there's nothing in the law that says that the repairs have to cost less than the house cost in the first place. Under the Slovak case, the court explained that people have a personal interest in having their own home, their personal property restored, when they have a personal use in it. That's why diminution in value is not the measure of damages for residential construction defects. I think I'm running really short on time, and so I just want to emphasize on the disclaimers that the jury rejected all of the arguments that the disclosures were complete and they were accurate, and the jury found that based on the misrepresentations and the omissions of material facts from the defendant, that the disclaimers and the waivers were not enforceable. And
it's striking out of that Exhibit F, did that render the agreement ambiguous?
Yes, striking out both of those exhibits rendered the document ambiguous, because it no longer makes sense for the builder to represent that these portions do not apply to these homeowners, and at the same time disclaim liability for damages related to the flooring system, where the flooring system provisions have been represented not to apply. I'm going to run out of time.
Well, take a moment, catch your breath, both sides. We'll confer and decide if we want any expansion on any of these points, because I respect that there's some back and forth, and you know who should get the last word may be a little unclear. We will give each side an additional 5 minutes, and you might give the bailiff a chance to set the clock accordingly. We'll start with the Hildebrand's attorney and just take your full 5 minutes, and that will give the defendant's attorney an opportunity to have the last word, which you expressed an interest in because of the cross appeal.
Thank you.
And if you want to take a minute and confer, that's fine.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm going to turn now to the public impact issue under the CCPA. The defendants argue that, as a matter of law, there is no public impact here, although the jury found that the defendants' deceptive trade practices significantly impacted the public. I also know, as outlined in the brief, that the defendants didn't preserve this issue for appeal. Okay, first, The Martinez versus Lewis case explains the factors for determining whether there is a public impact. The first factor is the number of actual and potential consumers affected, and there's no particular number required by the case. There's no certain magic number that you have to reach in order to have a public impact. Here, the defendants built 49 homes in the subdivision, and there were 49 homeowners that were making the biggest investment of their lives. And so, as to all of these homes, there were misrepresentations regarding the applicable warranty, and the evidence of that is set out in detail in the opening brief.
How can we assess the impact of that, though, because we don't know if anybody else, of the other 48 people, we don't know which of them essentially understood that they had to buy year two and then went ahead and bought year two, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, that's not the applicable standard. As the Hall case explained, when deceptive trade practices are disseminated or directed toward the market generally, it affects 100% of the actual and the potential consumers. So, for example, in the Hall versus Martinez case, the defendant there advertised for sale 47 lots, and they advertised that the lots were for sale with a particular egress road, and it turns out that they actually had no right to that egress road. And the people who brought the complaint in the case were the homeowners who own land, the owners of the land on that false egress road. So they brought a case under the CCPA, arguing that these deceptive trade practices, falsely advertising these 47 lots for sale, resulted in injury to them and impacted the public. And the court found that those trade practices were directed to the market, and
But in Hall, wasn't there advertising in the traditionally understood sense of newspaper or other mass media?
In Hall, the lots were advertised for sale as real estate normally is, and it's the same as in this case. These homes were listed for sale on the MLS. There were sales brokers hired to advertise the homes for sale. There were small homes.
Okay. You could have put in evidence that the New Vista printed up 100,000 brochures and gave away every one of them. Is there any such evidence in the record?
The number of the brochures, no, but there was evidence that there were.
Okay, you could have put in evidence that here's a newspaper ad in the Denver Post or the Aurora Sentinel that contains misrepresentations. Is there any such evidence in the record?
Not in the Denver Post or the Aurora Sentinel, but there is evidence that the advertisements were misleading. And actually, there were two ways that the advertising created a false impression. First, by the affirmative misrepresentations about the warranty, and that the homes came with individual soils reports, implying that the soils engineer's recommendations were followed. And also, there was non-disclosure of material information that created a false impression about these products for sale. And it isn't required, for example, in the Hall case, there were just the two owners of the land with the egress road who showed how they were injured by the deceptive trade practices. They were not required to show how the 47 other purchasers of the land were harmed by the trade practices. But here, it's clear that there were 49 homeowners, and these were all the homes that they built in the subdivision, and the sump pump requirement was ignored for all of these homeowners unless there was water in their pit when the pit was dug. And as to at least 38 homeowners on lots 1 through 38, the homes were built defectively. Whether or not the rug started to heave or not, or they will in the future, it doesn't matter. They were built incorrectly and not in conformance with the soils report. Thank you.
I'd like to address the issue of the warranty since you brought that up, Your Honor. My reading of the documents, the warranty documents and the purchase agreement, are that the Hildebrands got their 10-year structural warranty. What they didn't get in year two was the extended warranty that the New Vista would come in and fix everything. which is basically, that was limited to the first year. They did not purchase that for the second year, but they still had the 10-year warranty for major structural defects. So there was, it's simply a non-issue.
Is there evidence in the record that demand was made on the third-party warranty during year two, and if so, how the third-party warranty provider dealt with that demand?
I don't know if it was in year two, but I believe that the Hildebrands did approach the third-party warrantor and were told that there was not a structural defect. But in fact, New Vista responded to a warranty request, even though the Hildebrands had not purchased year two. Hildebrands still responded to a year two warranty request. They had the structural engineer, the Jackson firm, go out and look at it. And the Jackson engineering firm said, these are not structural defects. Yes, I see cracks. New Vista came in and they filled the cracks. They replaced the patio. They did warranty work, even though they were beyond the year one warranty for New Vista. So that whole thing is a non-issue. Should have been decided that way from the court by looking at just the documents themselves. In addition, in terms of the soils reports, the only material soils report is the lot-specific report, and that allowed either-or option. Project-wide soils report that was 145 pages long included exactly the same information that was in the lot-specific report, but included it for all the other lots in the subdivision. There's no legal basis for saying that plaintiffs needed to see lot information for every lot in the project in order to make the decision as to purchase the house or not. The preliminary letter that was 3 pages long, that was the first thing issued March 8 of 2001 prior to the other reports that had the actual objective testing information. That was incomplete. It referred to low to moderate and high expansive soils and did not address specifically the issue of low to moderate, which is where Mr. Garner testified this lot fell into. So it didn't even cover the type of soils that were on this lot. And there's no logical reason under the soils report that someone selling a house is going to produce a 3-page letter that was issued months before the actual soils tests were done and issued in a lot-specific report. Does the panel have any additional questions on specific issues?
Well, I do. The lot-specific report says, quote, use of a slab on grade system could be considered. Then it goes on to use the word recommend or recommended with respect to a structural floor. Why isn't that sufficient in light of the plaintiff's expert testimony for the jury to consider whether Mr. Reeves disregarded the engineer's quote recommendation on?
Because the recommendation encompassed both options. That's what Mr. Garner testified to at trial, and that's what the documents say.
Is there any document in this case where Mr. Garner or his company says, I recommend a slab on grade floor?
Not in terms of I recommend that you do this instead of the other. Merely, you have these options, and either of them are sufficient in my experience and judgment as a professional engineer. I would also point out that
well, let me come back to it since you asked for specifics.
Yes.
In terms of the rough-in plumbing, the upgrade worksheet in the plaintiff's own contract that Mr. Reeves countersigned says, quote, rough-in basement bath. close quote. Isn't that sufficient for a jury to conclude that a reasonable purchaser might have believed that the basement was suitable for finishing to include a bathroom?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, based on the language in the purchase agreement, which specifically says roughed in, finished, you know, it's only to be used as a bathroom and to be finished as a bathroom if it's a structural floor. And if it's not, then that plumbing is meant to be laundry, a sink, a laundry sink.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. We appreciate counsel's arguments. We also appreciate your accommodating us on the shifting scheduling arrangements. The case will stand submitted. We will issue a written opinion.